from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Friday afternoon to you. I am Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 17th of July, 2020. Coming up on today's edition of Washington Watch, yesterday, the Commission on Unalienable Rights released a draft of its long-awaited report in which the commissioners argued for a grounding of American diplomacy in the principles of America's founding. The document was presented during an event at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and I have a conversation with Dr. Peter Berkowitz, Executive Director of the Commission on Unalienable Rights. In my second block, I've got Eric Metaxas, New York Times best-selling author and senior fellow at the King's College, on cultural warfare, founding principles, burning churches, and a constitutional republic under attack. At the bottom of the hour, a federal judge in Maryland ruled on Tuesday that during the COVID pandemic, women do not need to abide by a policy requiring they go to a medical facility in order to obtain chemical abortion drugs. Instead, healthcare providers could mail or otherwise deliver abortion pills directly. I've got Dr. Michael New, professor of social research and political science at the Catholic University of America and research fellow at the Charlotte Lozier Institute, with his take. And in my last block, I've got Michael Brown, president and professor of practical theology at Fire School of Ministry, and his new book, Evangelicals at the Crossroads. Plus, I'll have foreign affairs reporter and Fox News contributor Gordon Chang on Attorney General William Barr's fiery condemnation of what he calls China's massive propaganda coup. A reminder, our website is tonyperkins.com for today's podcast. Follow us there. Find resources and information to help you flesh out today's program. Follow us also on Twitter at T. Perkins, at Sarah P. Perry, or at FRCDC. And again, you know the app. Stand Firm is the app. You can find it in your Apple or Google Play stores. We've rebuilt it, and we've made the show portable for you. You can just search your store for Stand Firm or follow the link on TonyPerkins.com.
We agreed that the Declaration of Independence itself is the most important statement of human rights ever written. It made human freedom and human equality our nation's central ideas. And as I said to the Claremont Institute now just over a year ago, we agreed that America draws strength and goodness from her founding ideals, and that our foreign policy must be grounded by those ideals as well. But we know this, we can't do good at home or abroad if we don't precisely know what we believe and why we believe it. And that's why I asked Professor Glendon to form a commission composed of some of the most distinguished scholars and activists. I asked them not to discover new principles, but to furnish advice on human rights grounded in our nation's founding principles and the principles of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Unalienable rights are a foundation upon which this country was built, central to who we are and to what we care about as Americans. Their protection was a foundation in the establishment of the United States over 200 years ago. And yesterday in Philadelphia, the State Department released its draft report on the Commission on Unalienable Rights. Joining me now to discuss it is Dr. Peter Berkowitz, himself Executive Director of the Commission on Unalienable Rights. Dr. Berkowitz, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's very good to be with you. Thank you.
I have to tell you that I found this report to be a love letter to America's founding. And it was, as someone who has been a student of history and who loves to read about the founding of America, truly an inspiring read in that it provides such clarity with why the principles we hold dear as Americans are important to others. But the report in and of itself kind of holds to a rather controversial notion that America's founding was good and that America itself is good. Do you find that to be the case?
I find it both to be the case and astonishing that it is the case. It is part of the circumstances in which we operate today that here in the United States today, especially among the educated class, it is regarded as a controversial argument that America is founded on magnificent principles, and that it's in light of those magnificent principles that the country has prospered to the extent that it has, becoming the world's, I speak this now descriptively, becoming the world's most prosperous, most powerful, most tolerant, and diverse liberal democracy.
And in fact, we find a lot of the cultural unrest is a gift in that these individuals are allowed to express themselves in manners legal or illegal, in manners appropriate or inappropriate. And the gift of their own expression is a function of how good America is herself, because you certainly couldn't try what individuals are doing now in attacking these statues, memorials, cultural icons, individuals, without realizing serious repercussions in a totalitarian regime. And yet here in America, we have the freedom to allow individuals a platform like this. It's sort of an appeal to the conscience of global humanity by looking at how we ourselves were formed. But there were some concerns going into this, and some of those concerns included concerns that other nations would be relying on their own traditions to further crush human rights. What do you say to those critiques?
I say to those critiques that first, there is a point. Any approach can be abused. But the deeper observation, I think, is that people who make that criticism actually do not understand the commitments that the United States took on in 1948 with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and what that document presupposes. That document recognized, in the wake of two world wars, that it was important to seek some basic core rights almost all nations could agree to as inseparable from our humanity. Mm-hmm. What emerged was this document, the UDHR. At the same time, the drafters of the document recognized that it would not be possible for the nations of the world, the different peoples of the world, who developed different cultures, emerged from different civilizations, they wouldn't be able to agree on the philosophical justifications for those principles. The hope was, the encouragement was, that the different nation states would look to their own cultures, their own civilizations, to find their distinctive justifications for some core principles: no torture, no genocide, mm-hmm. no arbitrary attention, arrest, detention, punishment, freedom of speech, of religion, and so on, down to and including certain understanding of social and economic rights. In other words, the UDHR presupposed that nations would turn to their own cultures. Now, you could say the United States in this regard is particularly lucky, because as the opening quotations you played suggest, at the heart of the American national spirit, at the very heart of our national spirit, is dedication to certain universal principles, mm-hmm. to certain ideas about the rights that inhere in all persons. People always ask, which persons? But that's the beauty of the American founding. Although we didn't honor it at first, all persons, period. If you're a human being, these unalienable rights are yours as your inheritance, as your endowment. That's at the very core of our national traditions.
And what a gift that is, to be able to experience that. You know, a lot of people have critiqued ahead of time, and there were certain very vocal critics, some who even sued to stop the commission's work because they were afraid that something like religious liberty would be elevated to the position of a super right at the expense of the rights of women or LGBTQ individuals. And in the presentation of this report, I find that not to be the case. But Dr. Berkowitz, what is your response to people who have a concern that this undue preferential discussion about religious liberty, wrongheaded though it may be, is somehow an indicator that this is not an equal or an even-handed treatment of the nation's founding?
Well, I have several quick reactions. First, part of our obligation was to describe accurately the American founding. And the fact of the matter is that religious freedom was regarded as one of the unalienable rights. So it was our job to report that accurately. But second, I make an empirical observation. that, and it's strange to me that so many experts in human rights are unaware of this obvious correlation. There is a strong correlation in our world between countries that protect religious liberty and countries that protect the whole range of basic rights and fundamental freedoms to which the United States is formally and informally dedicated. And it's really not a surprise when you reflect upon it, because down through history, what has generally been the most contentious matter? Well, actually, after quarrels about property, I want that land, you want that land, it is quarrels about what God wants of us, how he wants us to live. And it was a great achievement. And in the American tradition, Western civilization, I should say, the idea of toleration, as you know, has deep roots actually within the biblical tradition.
Yes.
But it was a great achievement to develop forms of society in which people who had differing views about how God wished us to live our lives could live together in peace and harmony within, of course, there always have to be certain limitations. But the idea that people of deep belief, deep religious conviction, or as it turns out, no conviction at all, could live together under law and pursue their understanding of what God requires of us in their own way, provided they obey the laws that apply to all citizens. That was a great development in human history. So if you can overcome that kind of difference of opinion, you can respect people's rights in all kinds of other spheres. So again, there's that that's that misunderstanding that to somehow protect religious liberty is to slight others. No, the empirical record is clear. If your country protects religious liberty, it's bound to protect the whole range. And if I may just make one other point,
please.
It is a very odd historical moment in which people tend to confuse those devoted to religious liberty with, excuse the expression, religious fanatics.
Yes.
It's as if people hear religious liberty and their knee-jerk reaction is, ah, those are the people who wish to impose religion upon us and take away liberties. No. The people who are defenders of religious liberty want a political society that, yes, it is so respectful of religion that it allows men and women of different faiths to live together. That's the opposite of theocracy. Now, it's true, this is what the critics do discern, and I think this is what upsets some of the critics who are more comfortable with a secular outlook. They suspect they're okay with religious liberty so long as the defense of it is based on secular skepticism toward religion. Mm. It's true that there is a religious basis for religious toleration. And power to it, I say.
Oh, Dr. Peter Berkowitz, we could go on. There is so much more to talk about there, but you've been a wonderful guest. We've been honored with your presence, Executive Director of the Commission on Unalienable Rights. He has been my guest for this segment. Coming up, I'll be continuing the discussion on founding principles and cultural revolution with New York Times bestselling author Eric Metaxas right after this on Washington Watch. Stick around.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership in Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Well, I cannot imagine that the Twitter mob likes the Commission on Unalienable Rights' new report much, because the commission, chaired by longtime Harvard legal scholar Mary Ann Glendon, contradicts virtually every element of the new political orthodoxy. You know, the same one that caused Barry Weiss, who was the New York Times opinion editor, to resign just a few days ago. It reinforces the ideal that though she is flawed, America is yet great. Joining me now to talk cultural warfare is Eric Metaxas, New York Times bestselling author and senior fellow at the King's College. Eric, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a joy.
So, one of your books is If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty. How close, based on what you're seeing culturally in America right now, how close are we to losing our constitutional republic?
Oh, listen, I wrote If You Can Keep It 4 years ago. And when I wrote it, I felt a huge urgency. I thought to myself, we have effectively ignored the founding principles for decades. You know, since the 60s, we've not been teaching these in public schools. We've not been really promoting them in our media and in kind of a bipartisan way of celebrating America. That went away in the 60s. And so when I wrote If You Can Keep It, I said to myself, the crazy thing is that if America is an idea, which it is, it means that this idea only works if the people understand the idea. In other words, if you're living in France or you're living anywhere else, you don't need to do anything in particular. You know, there's a bureaucracy. You just do what they tell you. If you're living in a tyranny, you just do what they tell you. But if you live in a free country, as free as this country has been, you have to do something. And so I realized before I wrote the book, while I was writing it, I said, we haven't taught this for decades. I barely understand this. No, I've only begun to understand it, or when I was writing the book, it had finally come to my attention through some books written by Oz Guinness. I said, we are on the very verge of losing everything. And people, when they hear that, they think it's hyperbole. They think I'm being dramatic. There is no question that we have, you know, it's like now you're running on fumes. You're
yes.
running on fumes, and once you lose it, it's gone forever. So in the last 4 years, the left has really gone crazy and has, in a sense, pushed things much farther. Now, the good news is we have a president and administration with people like, you know, Secretary Pompeo, who really get this. And, you know, that's why Pompeo called on Marianne Glendon to head this up, because if we do not teach these things like yesterday, if we don't teach these things in a fun way, I mean, it's one thing to have a commission to put out a report, but we have to understand what freedom is. We have to celebrate it, because mm-hmm. there is no question, Sarah, none, that we are absolutely on the precipice of losing it. And maybe this is the key. When you lose it, you know, it's not like, oh, we're in debt. Well, you can get out of debt. This is
yes.
falling off a cliff. When you fall off a cliff, you die and it's over. You can't crawl back up. It's over. And we have effectively been there. And I see it as an existential crisis along the
yes.
lines of 1776 or 1860. We need to face this moment. And I think that, you know, this is a good start. Because of what the secretary did and Marianne Glendon did in this commission, you know, you and I are talking about this on the program. But most people my age and younger have no clue about the gloriousness of freedom and self-government, which
mm-hmm.
we ought to be teaching and celebrating. So it's something I take, you can tell from the tone of my voice, as seriously as I take anything, because the whole world is looking to America. It's not just about America. The entire
yes.
world looks to us to be a beacon of freedom. There's many examples, even in Pompeo's comments today, that, you know, I don't know if it was Nathan Sharansky was saying that in the Soviet Union, when Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire, all of the dissidents felt hope. They thought, my goodness, there's somebody out there who's aware of our plight, who
mm-hmm.
fights, who believes in freedom, the freedom of the individual, and so on and so forth. So it affects the whole world. God, by his grace, has allowed America to hold this torch. And if we drop it, there's nobody waiting in the wings to pick it up.
Is there any way to appease these cultural assailants? We've got about a minute here left, but is there anything they can be given that will make the assault on American principles and founding ideals and iconography even for Catholic churches all vandalized or burned over the weekend? What do they want?
Anything we can give them. Okay, listen, the first thing we need to understand is they don't know what they want, and if we give them anything, we're fools. They don't. This is about revolution. This is not.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about saying, "Oh, you gave us that. Thank you very much." It's like the Palestinians. You know, if you finally give them everything they want, they say, "You know what? It's not good enough." They
right.
want to be victims. They want to destroy everything. I said the other day in my appearance on Tucker Carlson, I said, "This is a rage against God and against all authority." They want to burn down Western civilization. Now, a lot of them don't know that consciously. But some of them do. Some of them are very dedicated cultural Marxists. You have to know that by promoting the truth and not giving a millimeter to these monsters, because that's what they are, they're violent thugs, that's the only way you can fight. And people need to find a voice of courage and to not give in. Don't get confused that this is about George Floyd or about racial justice. This is
yeah.
a Marxist anti-American organization that is cynically using the incident of George Floyd and other things to promote things that are going to crush America. And by the way, if you care about blacks in America, supporting BLM would be the worst thing you could ever do. That's
oh,
it.
Absolutely. Eric, I'm so glad you made that distinction. Truly, George Floyd's death was the spark that set off a deep and smoldering fire, one that's been there for quite a long time. The Black Lives Matter organization, as we talked about yesterday, it's not an organization that has the interests of America at heart. Coming up next, a federal judge in Maryland has removed in-person requirements for accessing abortion pills. We'll talk to Professor of Social Research and Political Science, Dr. Michael New, about it right after this on Washington Watch.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry sitting in with you on this Friday afternoon, July 17th, 2020. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Make sure you have the Stand Firm app. You can get it in your smartphone Play Store, or you can follow the link on TonyPerkins.com. Well, a federal judge in my home state of Maryland has removed in-person requirements for accessing abortion pills. Because why not? We don't allow any restrictions on accessing abortion, not even when it's up to and including the day of labor for active birth. Apparently, such a restriction is an undue burden for women seeking an abortion during the COVID pandemic. So joining me now is Professor of Social Research and Political Science at the Catholic University of America, who is also a research fellow at the Charlotte Lozier Institute, Dr. Michael New. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so talk to me about the risks that in-person abortion actually presents to women. This seems easy enough, right? So it's so in keeping with this terrible spate of judicial precedent that's been created, allowing women easier and easier, absolutely unfettered, no holds barred access to abortion at any time, place, measure. But here we are with chemical abortions. Explain to me how that's a health risk for women.
It's a very substantial health risk. I mean, we have good data that chemical abortions tend to be a lot riskier than surgical abortions. The best study I saw was published back in 2015. It was published in Obstetrics and Gynecology, and it was very comprehensive. They had very good data, comprehensive data, on state Medicaid patients. And they looked at women who had surgical abortions, and they looked at women who had chemical abortions. And they found that those women who had chemical abortions, and this is, again, with supervision, had four times the complication rate of women who had surgical abortions. Mm. Women who had surgical abortions were twice as likely to have a major complication as the woman who underwent a surgical abortion. And, again, this is with medical supervision. So we already know these abortions are very risky. So letting women do these abortions or obtain these abortions without, you know, any kind of supervision only magnifies and increases those health risks.
What are some of these health risks that we're worried about? What are, speaking from, for example, a medical perspective, what do we have to worry about in terms of this particular method of abortion?
I mean, one of the big health risks is hemorrhaging. I mean, that happens quite often. Finland, there's a very good study there that found that 20% of women who had chemical abortions suffered some kind of adverse effect. I think over 15% reported hemorrhaging. There's a lot of, you know, anecdotes and even data about, you know, incomplete abortions. That's not healthy. that's going to certainly require another trip to the physician. That can pose significant long-term, you know, health risks. So again, there's, you know, a number of health risks involved with chemical abortions, some even more severe. I mean, there's stories about women who have undergone abortions, both chemical and surgical, who can no longer have children afterwards. Mm. So again, the health risks are substantial. And again, allowing women to obtain these abortions without any kind of direct contact with a doctor, again, only increases those risks.
Well, we've seen a political permutation, sort of a metamorphosis from safe, legal, and rare in the post-Roe era to the current demand that it is a civil right to be able to have an abortion. So here we are. This is a restriction that was removed based on undue burdens related to the COVID pandemic. And we understand, obviously, that there are certain necessary precautions based on COVID, and yet they are providing this medication that is given directly to them in the comfort of their own home to be able to terminate a life. Do you anticipate that a ruling like this during COVID just paves the way for less common sense restrictions on abortion, the procedure overall going forward?
I'm concerned that it does. I mean, people who support legal abortion have been pushing this for a long time, even before the COVID pandemic. I mean, they have they've introduced like telemed abortions in Iowa, where there's no face-to-face meeting with a physician. They interact with that physician through Skype or through some computer networking program, and then a drawer opens up, which contains the abortion pill, and they consume the pill. So you have telemed abortions in Iowa. You have, I think, telemed abortions in Maine. And even before the pandemic, the ACLU was filing a lawsuit to try to make the abortion pill available from pharmacists. So again, they've been acting for a long time to try to make this pill more available with less medical supervision. The other side realizes that abortion facilities are closing, which is in general a great thing.
Yes.
I think according to Operation Rescue, the numbers between 1991 and 2017 fell from about 2,100 to just over 700. So that's like a two-thirds decrease in abortion facilities, and that's a kind of a great cause for celebration. So they're trying to find other ways to make abortion laws more permissive, and telemed abortions and having these abortion pills be delivered by mail. Again, that's a new strategy for them, and in the pandemic, unfortunately, it looks like it was successful.
Well, and we also know that there have been attempts by some of the larger abortion providers like Planned Parenthood, who work with a network of national affiliates, to get their hands on PPP, Paycheck Protection Funds, which simply ensures that they can continue in the nature of ending human life more easy than they have before. So we see this increasing evidence of accessibility to abortion. And we have the COVID pandemic, which reins us in to a certain extent, provides some corralling of the fact that we're not always able to get procedures done. And yet here we see the use of the pandemic as an opportunity to shoehorn in an agenda that does nothing but harm women ultimately in the outcome based on these pre-existing risks. It's unbelievable. Dr. Michael New has been my guest, visiting scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and professor at Catholic University of America. We've got a very busy D block coming up. Some people may scratch their heads when they learn that evangelicals almost exclusively support Trump based on recent data. But we're going to talk to President and Professor of Practical Theology at Fire School of Ministry, Michael Brown, about it right after this. Plus, we've got some developments post-Attorney General Barr speech on China. We'll hear from Gordon Chang on that coming up next on Washington Watch. Could you use some timely and original commentary to read this summer, specifically on the issues facing our culture today? FRCblog.com has just what you're looking for. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, members of the Family Research Council team, as well as outside contributors. You can learn about religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Check out this list of a few of our most recent titles. What Does It Mean to Be a Woman? DC Christians Take to the Streets to Sing, Lament, and Pray, and Prayerfully Responding to Civil Unrest. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and stand for truth. Our blog helps you do just that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com. On April 16th, President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force announced a three-phase plan with guidelines for how states can begin scaling back restrictions. Churches should begin putting in place plans to reopen and operate their ministries according to the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control as state officials begin lifting orders. Here at Family Research Council, we have summarized the White House three-phase plan and how it relates to in-person church meetings and gatherings. Check out our resource, What Pastors Should Know About the White House Plan to Open Up America Again. Our resource offers practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate safely as our country reopens. Visit frc.org/church guidelines to view this resource and learn more. There, you'll also find our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus. Again, that's frc.org/church guidelines.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It is Friday, July 17th. I am Sarah Perry sitting in with you today. I hope you've had a great week. Happy early weekend. Go to TonyPerkins.com before you log off today. You'll find some information helpful in breaking down deeper today's segments. While evangelicals today are deeply divided over Donald Trump, this comes as no surprise. This dominates nearly every news cycle. We know it's an election year, but we are a few months out from a potential re-election or change of administration in the White House. Some see Trump as a savior figure anointed by God to make America great, as he's promised. Others see him more like the Antichrist, doing harm to the nation and bringing embarrassment to the church. So how do we square these two ideals, and what really is the evangelical case for Trump? Joining me now to talk about it is prolific author and president and professor of practical theology at Fire School of Ministry, Michael Brown. Michael, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Sarah.
Okay, so the new book is called Evangelicals at the Crossroads: Will We Pass the Trump Test? What is the test of the aforementioned title?
Yeah, so the Trump test is this. We know that Donald Trump is quite a unique figure. On the one hand, has done more for evangelical causes than probably any president in our memory. On the other hand, by our association with him because of his bad behavior and characteristics, he's hurt the evangelical cause. So here's the question, and this is, to me, the big Trump test. Mm-hmm. Can we vote for Trump, support Trump, and show solidarity with him without destroying our Christian witness in the process? And the second question, can we unite around Jesus as evangelical Christians while having different views about Trump? Because right now, we're tearing each other up in yes. front of the whole world on social media. We're not doing a good job there. And we tend to go to one extreme or the other on Trump. Either we savage him or we look to him as some kind of savior figure. I believe there's a path where we can support him as president, give our reasons to a watching world as to why we vote for him, while pointing to our own lives as testimony. So it's critical we get this right, because the world is watching, and we've never had a situation like this in our history.
Oh, well said. I have to tell you, I've heard from many evangelical leaders, and actually the night of the election, was talking to a family member who brought this to mind, that in many ways, Trump was a modern-day Cyrus. Can you answer the question of whether or not you believe that's the case?
Yes, there's a whole chapter in my book where I answer the question, did God uniquely raise up Donald Trump? So on the one hand, the unlikeliness of his being elected. Remember Election Day? It is over.
Yes.
He's not going to win. Hillary's already decorating the White House. It's
yes.
a done deal. So the shock of all the news commentators, that was amazing to behold. But there were actually Christian leaders who were likening Donald Trump to a Cyrus figure months earlier, early in the campaign. And who is Cyrus? He was a foreign king, a pagan king, who rather than doing what normal pagan kings did, which is crush the exiles in their empire, instead he restored the exiles back to their homeland. So the Bible in the book of Isaiah speaks of Cyrus, and God says, I raised you up even though you don't know me, and you're going to restore the Jewish people to Jerusalem. So in the book, I actually quote from what's called the Cyrus Cylinder, which was written in 539 B.C., and Cyrus is praising the god Marduk, the Babylonian god, for raising him up and saying he's the king of all kings. I mean, he sounds like a very self-centered guy worshiping
right.
other gods, but God used him. So that's the whole thing with Trump. He's not a perfect man. He's the last guy we would have picked. I mean, during
yes.
the primaries, I was anti-Trump and liked everybody else first. But it seems that God had a purpose in raising up this fighter to stand for our cause, to stand for religious liberty, to appoint good people to the courts, to stand with Israel, I mean, to move the embassy to Jerusalem.
Yes.
Of all things, you go down the list, fight against Islamic terrorism, fight for the unborn, do so many good things, push back against radical LGBTQ extremism, stand up to China. I mean, you need this fighter with a backbone of steel to do it. The problem is, he's Trump. He does things in ways contrary to what we would have said. Look, for years, we've been the character counts, morality matters people. Clinton's not fit. He shouldn't be in office. You know, now we're embracing this guy. So what we have to say to the world is, look, he's our president. He's not our savior. If you want to know my life, watch my life. Watch my testimony. Look at how I behave in my neighborhood, my community. Look at my family. That's who I am. Jesus gets my all in all. When I have a binary choice between Hillary or Trump or Biden or Trump, it's an easy decision to make.
Yes. Yeah. And this is, I'm so glad that you said that, because this in our own household has been the subject of many discussions, because I think we hear that evangelicals, if you would believe some in the media, evangelicals are being used as a prop by Trump, or they're sort of unflaggingly loyal to him in a period of perhaps sort of character deficiency as they see it. And they believe that this is somehow at odds with the character of who we are as followers of Jesus Christ. And yet what you say, it makes perfect sense to me and brings clarity to the issue. Who I am, how I live my life, Jesus in me and the way I live so that he might be glorified, and the presidential choice between A or B are not mutually exclusive. They can coexist. And for those who are political animals alone, I have to tell you, if you are giving me the choice between a Clinton and a Trump or a Biden and a Trump, there is no choice. It is very, very easy for me to make a choice there. And I have to say also, and I'm curious as to your thoughts, what do you do if you decide I'm going to vote third party or I'm going to write in a vote? Is that sort of a sufficient moral answer to some evangelicals who might find themselves in a bit of a quandary?
Obviously, people have to vote their conscience, and they have to do what they feel is right before God for their own lives. But the big question is, what are we actually voting for? In other words, the way the leftist media has painted things, if you vote for Trump, you're a white supremacist, you're a racist, you're a bigot, you're a hater, you've sold your soul, you want to put children in cages. That's the way they've pushed, and, mm-hmm. and many Christians are reacting against that, feeling, I have to prove myself. Well, what are you proving? We're having a simple vote about platforms, about who's
yes.
going to carry things out better. Look, in the state of New York, they recently banned so-called conversion therapy, and they said if you want to counsel an adult with unwanted same-sex attractions, it's
yes.
illegal. So an Orthodox Jewish counselor fought that with the help of the Alliance Defending Freedom, and immediately New York reversed itself. They said,
yes.
okay, we back up. I thought, what happened? Well, what happened was they knew the court this was going to was one that had Trump appointees who
mm-hmm.
were conservative. In other words, these things trickle down. These things trickle down to our schools. right now, because the Trump administration reversed what the Obama administration was doing, if you're a 15-year-old boy and you want to play on the girls' sports team and share the locker room and shower stalls, and your school says no, you won't be penalized. Under the Obama administration, you could theoretically lose your funding.
Yes.
So that's what we're voting for. Who's going to stand up to China better, Joe Biden or Donald Trump? Who's going to oppose Islamic terrorism? Who's going to stand with Israel? Who's going to fight for religious liberties? Those are the things that we as value voters point to. And look, we would like someone who wasn't so nasty, mean-spirited, juvenile, who didn't lie the way he does, who doesn't insult people the way he does.
Yes.
But that's for us to do. Let us set the tone. Let us set it. When he says something we don't like, say, yeah, we don't like that, but, you know, he's doing a better job on the economy than this one, and that's
right.
Helping you out. Yeah, I don't like that tweet. I wish he wouldn't do it. Like, great speech at Mount Rushmore, pro-civil rights and all that. And then the next day he goes after Bubba Wallace with NASCAR.
Right.
I don't
right.
like that. It's stupid. On the other hand, he made the good decisions I've asked him to, and the good court appointees, and fighting for our religious liberties. And the other thing is, if I go third party, if I send in a protest vote, okay, everyone has to make that decision, but am I not perhaps voting for social anarchy? Am I not perhaps opening the door a little bit more for the radical left to rise up?
Agreed.
So one main reason I voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and plan to vote again is because of the alternatives. Al Mohler, Southern Baptist leader, couldn't get himself to vote for Trump in 2016. He said, yes, he's been a huge embarrassment for the church, but I'm voting for him in 2020 because I look at the alternatives.
There
That's
you go.
Where we're at.
The book is Evangelicals at the Crossroads, Will We Pass the Trump Test, by Dr. Michael Brown. Get your hands on it, friends. Now, I've got to switch gears. I'm going to go international again. We started with the Secretary of State and the Commission on Unalienable Rights, and we're going to talk about China, because there seems to be every moment some development, some new development from the CCP. And just yesterday, AG Barr delivered remarks on China policy at the Gerald Ford Presidential Museum in Michigan. He said that the Chinese government has achieved a, quote, massive propaganda coup by shaping the content coming out of Hollywood, saying that U.S. business executives are acting as agents of the communist regime. Wow, if that doesn't make your hair stand up. Joining me now is foreign affairs reporter and Fox News contributor Gordon Chang. Give him a follow on Twitter if you don't already, at Gordon G. Chang. Welcome back to the program, Gordon.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
So you had to have been encouraged by what was nothing short of a blistering rejoinder against businesses' partnership with communist China, were you not?
Oh, I think the Attorney General's speech was absolutely fantastic. We need to hear people from the U.S. government speak in such clear and resolute tones. And, of course, we've got the Secretary of State doing the same thing. We're hearing it from so many other officials. This is now, Sarah, a whole-of-government approach on China, and that's exactly what we need. This mm-hmm. is well-conceived. This is disciplined. This is going in the right direction.
I think there has been for too long an availability issue or an economic issue alone. And so the availability of what China produces for us at an economic savings to us has probably driven so much of previous international economic policy. And we finally have a president who's a negotiator who has said, no, thank you. I will find a way to do it here, make it here, produce it here, give jobs here, and in so doing, break ties with a totalitarian regime. In fact, Barr even pointed out that he was making a sort of comparison to World War Z, where there was a scene of a zombie apocalypse that originated in China. It's as if everybody over at Paramount or Miramax is sort of operating the same way, because they all removed the scene at the behest of the CCP. It's stunning to me that the CCP and Xi Jinping can snap their fingers and the rest of Hollywood jumps. What do you owe that to?
Well, it's because movie companies really want to tap into the Chinese market. They know that Beijing is going to be extremely strict, and so they're self-censoring, as the Attorney General said. And we've had a number of movies over the last decade where all of a sudden, you know, there's some sort of calamity in the U.S., and who comes to the rescue? Well, it's China. This really is quite stunning, because you can't put a Chinese villain into any of these movies these days because of that consideration. I think that it's terrific. earlier, the Attorney General, when he was speaking to Maria Bartiromo, said, look, you know, if business thought this way 70 years ago, we'd be all be speaking German now. And
yes.
He's absolutely right about that.
I do believe that there is a particular danger, and I'm curious as to your take, about the big tech influence with China on those big tech providers, because this is the module through which we disseminate and digest information. And yet Chinese influence appears particularly nefarious. And we know they are very, very gifted in terms of finding ways to utilize American technology to their profit and our detriment. TikTok, perfect example. Does it bother you more when we're talking big tech, or the same amount? Because Hollywood's one thing, business is one thing, at least you can see it coming. Tech to me seems insidious in that type of a partnership.
Well, it certainly is. Just for instance, let's take Google. Google has these artificial intelligence partnerships and operations in China. It has the Google AI Center, and it had partnerships with Peking University and Tsinghua University. The reason why this is important is because in China, there's no such thing as civilian cooperation on technology, because they've got this civil-military fusion, as they call it, that everything that the military wants is pipelined directly into the military, even though the foreign company thinks it's in a civilian operation.
Do you think that America's corporations, those major governmental, those major organizational leaders, are really lobbyists for China in a sense?
Well, they have been. And in fact, matter of fact, the Attorney General yesterday said, look, you know, some of these companies are so close to the line, they may have to register under the Foreign Agents Act, FARA. And that really was a stunning statement from the Attorney General. So clearly that's the case. They have been lobbying for China. China hasn't had to spend that much money in Washington, largely because it's got the likes of Boeing and General Motors and Google and Microsoft doing their work for them.
You know, I find it interesting that Barr went so far as to say that for American companies in the global marketplace, free and fair competition with China has long been a fantasy. Will it ever be anything but a fantasy to have a free and fair trade relationship with the CCP?
No, you can't. The Communist Party does not believe in the notion of comparative advantage, which underpins the international trading system. This is a fantasy, and we have seen China's trade behavior deteriorate over time, especially after it joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. So we've got to just look at the facts that, you know, more and more trading with China has pushed China in the wrong direction, and that is something we can't ignore.
It was interesting to me that Attorney General Barr called this a blitzkrieg, that it is essence, it is leadership, it is predominance at all costs, no matter what the costs are, human, economic, corporate, or otherwise. This is an organization of cowards, individuals who are willing to do business with a totalitarian empire, communist enterprise, and they would do well to think twice moving forward in such a relationship. This has been Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. It's been my privilege to sit in with you today on Friday the 17th. I'll be back with you on Monday on that edition of Washington Watch. Have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.